This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm really delighted to have in the studio with me Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, one of the leading U.S. scholars on the Middle East. I know that I and many other people I know have found his blog, Informed Comment, at juancole.com to be absolutely indispensable over the last decade or so in making sense of what's going on in the Middle East and U.S. policy toward the Middle East, which we'll be talking about today. Juan Cole, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Were you surprised by the Arab Spring?
No, not very much. Of course, we were all surprised by the suddenness of the events and the quick overthrow of these dictators. But that year, the 1st of January, I did my top 10 list of foreign policy challenges to the United States. And I said on January 1st that there was going to be a transition in Egypt. Mubarak was old and he was clearly going out. And then I said there had been a lot of social activism and labor activism using Facebook and Twitter, and there seemed to be a lot of restiveness among the youth and the workers. And I said the Obama administration should have a plan for dealing with Egypt that doesn't depend just on repressing people as in the past, because it was clear to me that there was going to be a big change there.
I mean, my uninformed perspective on Egypt, because I'm not a scholar of the Middle East, was, you know, Mubarak is going to hand it over to his son, who we seem to be, you know, grooming for that position. You didn't think that that was likely?
I thought there would be trouble about it.
Now, when the Arab Spring happened, it seemed to me that the Obama administration was kind of late to the dance, especially in Egypt, and it never really got to the dance as far as Bahrain, for instance, is concerned. How do you evaluate the Obama administration's response to the Arab Spring?
Well, the Obama administration is an American government, and the United States is a superpower, and it's a status quo power. So you don't expect it to be, you know, really enthusiastic about big changes in the world, especially ones that may not benefit its interests. And I think Obama held on to Mubarak way too long. And really only turned on him a few days before he was obviously going out anyway. Obama was getting enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia to support Mubarak to his last breath.
And from Israel, too.
And from Bibi Netanyahu in Israel. Mm-hmm. So those are very major allies of the United States in the region, and Obama is not a foreign policy wonk. He's mainly devoted himself to domestic issues. So you could imagine that he would have trouble bucking both Israel and Saudi Arabia and doing something that might cost the United States its strategic position in the region. And so he really came to the conclusion very late in the day that Mubarak couldn't survive, and then he helped to usher him out.
Did he get points for that with the Egyptian people ultimately, or did they just focus on the fact that he was tardy?
I think once he ushered Mubarak out, or helped to, that he took the United States off the table a bit for the Egyptian revolutionaries. They were always concerned that foreign policy is easy to use to divide and rule people and to divert attention from domestic issues. And these people who made the revolution in Egypt, they were about like factory workers being badly paid, or the inability of people freely to form unions and engage in collective bargaining. They were what I call the Arab New Left. Their parents had probably been, you know, supporters of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the revolutionary leader of the 50s and 60s in Egypt, or they had been communists, or they had been socialists. And those parties had all disintegrated. So these young people from leftist backgrounds and then the people that they brought in to their movement were just a network. They weren't they weren't tightly organized as parties, and they networked a lot on social media. So, but their commitments were domestic. They were worried about the secret police. They were worried about civil liberties. Torture was a big issue for them. Arbitrary arrest, press censorship, and then the labor issues. So, if that's your main concern, and somebody brings up, well, the United States backed Mubarak, you know, then it becomes anti-imperialism, and the whole issue stops being how much are the factory workers being paid, or did your friend get arrested last week? And it becomes, you know, about these abstract big issues of geopolitics. And they were determined not to let that happen. So I think there were anti-American and anti-Obama posters in Tahrir Square in the first days of the revolution in 2011 in January. But once Obama showed that he wouldn't stand in the way of the revolution, then those posters disappeared. I spent a lot of the summer of 2011 in Tahrir Square, and I never saw anything about the United States one way or another.
What was it like to be there?
It was like a county fair. People would come out, especially at night because it was hot during the day. But they would roast corn cob and make Kharkhoday tea, and there were five stages, and people would go up on the stage spontaneously, and they would recite poetry, or they would give a political speech. I heard one man saying that the military dominance has to go, because in a democracy there are three branches of government, and the military inevitably controls all three when it's in power. So if you can have a real democracy with a separation of powers, then you have to get rid of the military. So I thought, gee, you know, Montesquieu has arrived in downtown Cairo. And the crowds, and some of the groups were musical groups or rappers, the crowds would kind of mill around these five stages, and whatever the best act was, the best speech or the best music, the best poetry, whatever, then there would be a surge and they would all go to that stage. So it was a really carnival atmosphere, and people were having a good time. It was deadly serious in some ways because they were calling for the end of a military dictatorship, which could get them thrown in jail and tortured. But they were very enthusiastic, and you saw all kinds of people, young, old, fundamentalist, secular. You can tell how they dress to some extent, and it was an amazing social display.
I'm speaking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. You probably know him from his blog, if you know about him, at Informed Comment. He's also been on the Colbert Report and other things, his commentary and analysis of what's going on in the Middle East is truly indispensable. Now, the right wing in the United States, or some members of it anyway, when they view President Obama's policy toward Egypt, take a different approach than I did at the outset, which was he was tardy, and say he should never have acted anyway, and that maybe they're against the Arab New Left, your expression, which is an analysis I hadn't thought of, but certainly they say they're against the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is all fanatical Muslims, and why are we playing ball with them? What's your take on that?
Well, Governor Mitt Romney lambasted Obama at the time in early 2011 for not backing Mubarak more strongly. And there's this meme that somehow the U.S., if it had just put enough of its support behind Mubarak, could have somehow kept him in power. And as you say, presumably the implication is maybe kept his son as a successor as well. And I don't understand that way of thinking, because if you've got nearly a million people in your capital downtown and they're angry and they're moving on the presidential palace, I don't think that's a long-term prospect here. So I don't think that Obama moved Mubarak out prematurely or failed to back him. I think he just saw the writing on the wall. And that had the United States collaborated with the Egyptian military in trying to repress this revolution, which would have inevitably involved firing on people, mass arrests, and so forth, that they would have failed, and they might well have pushed the revolution in a much more radical direction. As it was, it was a demand that Mubarak leave. And it didn't really change the power structures or certainly the socioeconomic structure of Egypt that much. And it left Egypt as more or less, in America's camp. The Camp David peace treaty with Israel survived. Relatively good relations with the United States survived. Until fairly recently, at least.
And what about the Egyptian military? To what extent is it still the power behind the throne?
Oh, the Egyptian military is still enormously powerful. Now, they had presidential elections in two rounds, in May and June. And the winner of the presidential elections turned out to be a Muslim fundamentalist, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Morsi. And, being elected by millions of people gives you a certain amount of authority and legitimacy, which is something that the Egyptian military did not have. It came to power in a coup in 1952, and it has guided the country ever since, and it has defended the country, it's fought wars, it's done a lot of infrastructural work, built roads, and it probably has, its own, it has its own sector of the economy. It owns a lot of the economy. Probably at least 5% of the economy is in the military's hands. But nobody elected them to do all that. They derived their power from this kind of charismatic coup in the post-colonial period that ushered out British dominance of Egypt. So Morsi now is the first popularly elected president of Egypt in history. They didn't have a presidential system previously. There have been elections. There have been prime ministers in the past. But they'd never had an elected president. And so he's used his legitimacy as an elected leader to begin to whittle down on the power of the military. So there was a military council, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or SCAF, which had 23 members, and which was acting as kind of overlord of the whole system. So yes, there's an elected parliament, yes, there's an elected president, but still ultimate power lies with SCAF. And Morsi has managed to fire a couple of the senior members of that military council, and I think he conspired with some of the younger officers to move them out. So he has made the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces less dominant in Egyptian politics than it had been even 2 months ago. But nevertheless, the military is a power to reckon with, and Morsi has to navigate his relationship to it.
And the fact that Morsi comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, should that concern Americans?
Well, the Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, goes back to 1928. And it's the first major form of what's called political Islam. In the early 20th century, you had all these currents competing for what was the best form of government. And you had kind of British and American liberalism, parliament elections, and so forth, with a free market system attached. But then you had communism. You had Arab nationalism of a radical sort. And then in that competition in the 30s, the Muslim Brotherhood arose as a third way. And what they said was initially that Egypt should be ruled as a Muslim country, that all the laws the British colonial authorities implemented should be repealed, and Muslim canon law, kind of on the analogy of Roman Catholic canon law, or the Talmud in Judaism, that old religious law of Islam should then be made the basis for the modern state. And in its early decades, the Brotherhood didn't talk much about democracy, to tell you the truth. It talked about having a supreme guide and so forth. So some of the laws they want to implement are retrograde. They're not good for women. What would you expect from medieval religious law? It's not like very progressive or politically correct. So they would favor, restrictions on women's travel. A woman would have to go get permission from her husband to have a passport, for instance. And so there would be restrictions on women's rights. And then medieval criminal law is also not, nice. So you could imagine cutting off the hands of thieves and stoning adulterers. And before we get too judgmental about these things, we should remember that stoning adulterers is in our scripture in the West as well. In fact, Jesus, as I remember, intervened in such a case. But I don't think the implication was that it should never happen. So there's worries about civil rights, about liberties, about criminal law, about the position of women. And then the Brotherhood had this remarkable transformation in the past couple decades, in which it now says it's committed to parliamentary democracy, that it formed a party, it wants to contest for seats, it wants to be kind of like the Christian Democrats, you know, the Christian party in Germany, which doesn't think it's the voice of God, and or at least doesn't say that very, very loudly publicly, and is willing to let, you know, the socialists or somebody else get in if they win the election. So the Brotherhood now says it's devoted to democracy. And so the big questions for Americans are, well, is this a lie? Are they saying they want elections, but actually, when they get into power, will they turn themselves into a dictatorship? And then how regressive are their policies going to really be socially? Are they going to be a human rights problem? So, and of course, one saw these things, these kinds of considerations occur 2 decades ago in Iran. So is the Muslim Brotherhood going to be another, you know, make Egypt another Iran? That's the big question.
And how do you answer that?
Well, so far, on the political side, there's not good evidence that the Brotherhood is insincere in its embrace of parliamentary democracy. It has been running in elections, and it says that if it's defeated, it'll go home, which is, you know, one of the basic definitions of democracy is that the losers go home when they're defeated. So I don't see signs that Morsi, having become elected as president, wants never to have another election. In fact, he may have to face another election fairly soon. Of course, one doesn't know the internal debates inside that party, and one doesn't know the future. But so far, I don't think there's a lot of reason for alarm in Morsi's behavior. It seems as though he really does want to be like the Christian Democrats in Germany.
I'm speaking with Juan Cole of the University of Michigan. His blog, Informed Comment, has been something that was just crucial, still is crucial reading for people who want to understand the region. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. For supporters of the State of Israel, I think having someone from the Muslim Brotherhood in charge of Egypt has been is a scary prospect for many. Do you see Egypt, you said it's still holding to the Camp David Accords. Is there going to be a problem there?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood certainly has been an organization that has a long history of anti-Semitic discourse. In their publications, going back to the 30s, they were one of the, you know, Western-style anti-Semitism wasn't common in the Arab world. They didn't have like a blood libel against Jews and things like that. And the Quran actually makes a place for, in the Middle East, for Jews and Christians to exist as legitimate communities. And that wasn't the case, say, in medieval Europe. I mean, the Jews were just like not allowed in many countries and so forth. So, but the modern European form of anti-Semitic discourse that, you know, Jews are conspiratorial and too rich and manipulative and all those kinds of accusations began being adopted by the Muslim Brotherhood in their publications from the 30s forward. Then the Brotherhood was had its hair on fire about the Jewish settlement in Palestine. And during the 30s, when the rise of fascism in Europe threatened the physical existence of Jews, and of course ultimately led to the Holocaust, in the 30s, a couple hundred thousand Jews managed to escape from the Nazis, even before it was clear how murderous the Nazis really would be towards them. And one of the few places they could go, because, you know, they weren't accepted in the United States or a lot of other countries, was the British Mandate of Palestine. It was then under British rule as a colony, and the British had announced that they would make a homeland for the Jews there. So the Brotherhood was very upset about this influx of Jews into Palestine in the 1930s. And from their local point of view, this looked like, you know, the Algerian, the French colonizing Algeria, or the Boers in South Africa. It looked like settler colonialism. I think it was a much more complex phenomenon than that because of the position of Jews in Europe and the rise of the Nazis. But that was what it looked like to the Muslim Brotherhood. And in 1948, when war broke out, many members of the Muslim Brotherhood went and fought on the side of the Palestinians and were irregulars there. And the Muslim Brotherhood was very much against the Camp David Accords when President Anwar Sadat conducted them in the late 70s. So the ideological basis for nervousness about the Brotherhood coming to power in Egypt, in Israel, is certainly legitimate. On the other hand, you know, there are reasons of state. And Israel has the best army in the region. It has defeated Egypt several times. It also, let's be frank, is a nuclear power and has on the order of 200 to 400 nuclear warheads. Egypt doesn't have any of that. It doesn't have the most advanced fighter planes. It doesn't have a nuclear element. It's despite being a much bigger country and having a bigger army, Egypt is no match for Israel militarily. And so that anybody in Egypt would want to go back to a war footing with Israel is just implausible. And so I think not because they're nice or because they like the Israelis, et cetera, will the Brotherhood accommodate itself to a continuation of the Camp David Accords, but just for reasons of state.
Juan Cole giving his take there on Egypt and Israel. I'd like also to talk about Iran and Israel and Iran and the United States. There's all this talk in the fall of 2012 about Israel wanting to bomb Iran or wanting to encourage the United States to bomb Iran. What's your sense of that?
Well, I don't think that it's very likely that the Israeli government would want to go to war with Iran by itself. I think what's going on is that the far right wing Likud government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants to put pressure on the United States to intervene militarily to stop Iran's nuclear enrichment program. Now, Iran has nuclear enrichment facilities in Natanz near the city of Isfahan, as well as new ones in a cave in the side of a mountain near Qom at Fordo. Those facilities are being inspected by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And although the agency has serious questions about Iran's activities, it continues to certify that no nuclear material has been diverted to military use. There isn't good evidence that Iran has a military nuclear weapons program. It has a civilian nuclear enrichment program, which it says is to make fuel for running power plants, to make electricity. And in that regard, is not doing something different from France or South Korea or whatever. The Israelis, especially the Israeli far right, is absolutely convinced without a shadow of doubt that this program is dual use. That is to say, it looks like a civilian program on the outside, but inside it's intended ultimately to produce a warhead. The Iranian religious system is also a governmental system, and so it's ruled by the Ayatollah-in-chief, if you will, Ali Khamenei. He has given religious rulings, kind of like papal encyclicals, saying that it's illegal in Islamic law to stockpile, to develop, to make, to use nuclear weapons. So the official line of the Iranian state is that it doesn't have a weapons program, never would have a weapons program, and that the outside world is being paranoid. And again, the intelligence that surfaced and the inspections of the UN agency involved don't contradict that Iranian stance powerfully. They raise questions, but they don't give evidence. But the Israelis are convinced that it's a weapons program, and they've managed to convince all of the American press that it's a weapons program, because you never see an accurate depiction of the program in the Western press. It's just assumed that it is a weapons program, even though there's not good evidence for it. Well, the Israelis are say that they feel existentially, or at least some Israelis say that they feel existentially threatened by this nuclear program of Iran. And I think really what's going on is psychological warfare. Israel is a small, vulnerable state. It's surrounded by hostile neighbors. Jews don't have to live in Israel. A lot of them are well-educated. They have technical skills. They could live lots of other places. And although there hasn't been significant out-migration from Israel by Jews, I think that the governmental authorities in Israel are always afraid that, you know, you could start a snowball effect, that people could just leave. And in opinion polling, a third of Israelis say that if Iran announced that it had an atomic bomb, the next day they would emigrate from Israel. So I think this is really all about keeping Israelis not only actually secure, but also psychologically secure in order to win the demographic battle with the Palestinians and keep foreign immigration from, you know, continuing to come into Israel. So I think the Israeli authorities just can't countenance a really powerful enemy state, because Iran doesn't like Israel. The Iranian state, it's not true that they have threatened to annihilate Israel, but they have a no first strike policy, the Iranians. They say they would never attack anybody. But they do wish that the Israelis would please drop dead. So they have a negative attitude towards
them. And that's not nice.
That's not nice. So the Israelis are very nervous about somebody who wishes you would drop dead who also has an atomic bomb. And what that might mean for just, you know, the psychological aspect of living day-to-day in Israel.
But even assuming worst case, assume Iran has this nuclear weapons program, assume it got a nuclear weapon, surely the people who run the Iranian regime would understand that if they dropped a nuclear bomb on Israel, that they would be obliterated, in the words of Hillary Clinton when she was running for president last time.
Yeah. Well, the likelihood that the Iranians, if they did have a bomb, would use it is very low. First of all, they'd kill all the Palestinians. It's Palestine and Israel are a small place. You can't blow up atomic bombs there without killing everybody. So if the Iranians are great champions of the Palestinians, you know, turning them into carbon dust is not a good way to show that. So even if they did want to kill Jews, which they say they don't, they couldn't use it. And then, of course, the retaliation would be horrible. So, but as I said, I don't think that this is about the actual military aspects of this conflict. I think it's all about psychology. Is that it's just, you know, you have to ask yourself, say you're a Jew, you live in Tel Aviv, and you know that there's a big country of 72 million not very far away which has a nuclear bomb and which really wishes you weren't there. How would that make you feel? And the purpose of the Israeli government is to make you feel good about being in Tel Aviv.
A new perspective on what might be happening in Israel vis-a-vis Iran, brought to you by Juan Cole, who's been my guest today on Progressive Radio. You can read his informed comment at juancole.com, and you can find The Progressive at progressive.org. Thanks so much for listening this week, and I'll be back again next week. Juan Cole, thanks so much for being my guest.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.